For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. That's right. For the record, lab on me going all the way. All the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. Stop calling. For the record, 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 for the record. For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's
right. Welcome back to The Clink, Stories of Redemption 2021. We're into season 3. This is our first episode back. What a story of redemption this man has. He's all the way from the States. He's a 3-time world champion, but life has not always been so good. Chris Luera, welcome to The Clink, my friend. And hey, how good is it to have you on?
I am very happy to be here. Thank you so much for having me on.
I can't help but sit here a little bit starstruck. You know, I've had the honor of sitting down with so many amazing people over the last 2 series, and here we are into season 3, 2021, and what a way to kick it off with your story of redemption. For those that don't know who Chris is, I'll just give you a little bit of insight. Chris was a baby, I believe, who was born with addiction. Lost his mum at the age of 1. Father put him up for fostering into care. Is that correct? A lot of jail, a lot of drugs, a lot of crime. A long journey of redemption that has you now at the top of your game. Chris, what an inspiration, mate. Take us back and tell us who you are.
Alrighty. Well, thank you again for having me. I'm very happy to be here. Well, my story starts off, like you said, started off with addiction. Both of my biological parents were heavy, heavy drug addicts and very deep in their addictions. My mother passed away when I was about 2 years old, 18 right. months, 2 years old. She overdosed. And at that time, my father put me in for an adoption. He put me in a foster home. And soon after that, he overdosed and he died. And I was adopted by my great aunt. I was in a foster home for about a year. And my great aunt found out about my mother passing away. And she adopted me and took me in as she became my mother. She's the only person I know as my mother.
Wow.
And she raised me as her own. She was with me. She gave me so much love, but the damage of being born into a drug house, being brought into a drug house with people with such heavy addictions and issues already, had already taken its toll that I didn't even know.
Had you, when you were born with addiction, Chris, and in Australia, it's known as a methadone baby. Is that the type of thing that you were brought into this world to confront from day dot?
I'm not 100% sure. Like, methadone is somebody that's trying to, it's used in replace of heroin.
That's correct. Yeah.
Right. It's like, it's and I very much believe that I don't know, but from the bits and stories that I've gotten from my stepsister and people over the years, I don't think that my mother was
trying to give it up.
Methadone.
Yeah.
I think that she was full fledged using.
Yeah.
And in the loss, you know, lost in her addiction. After coming down into a new home, I found drugs and alcohol very young. I had a lot of questions. I was told my mom and dad that raised me, that became my mom and dad after they adopted me, they told me about my mom and dad. They told me that they had issues. They told me that they passed away. And I do believe that they had the best intentions, but they did inform me about my mother and father's problems in the sense of, this is what you come from, so you have to be careful not to become this.
How did you feel? Did you at any, I mean, I know you were young, but in your mind, was this who your mum was? Not your mum that had passed, but your great aunt that has taken you on. I mean, initially, were you always aware that she was, you know, a family member, or was it something that You thought that that was mom until you were told.
I only knew her as my mom. I have no memory of acknowledging somebody different as mom.
Wow.
But I knew that she wasn't my mother. She was my guardian. She was everything that I looked to for a mother.
Yes.
But I knew at a very, very young age that she was not my mother. When I started school, it was one of the first things that I got bullied for that I didn't recognize as being bullied, but I got picked on. I got asked questions of, why is your grandma always picking you up? You know, what happened to
your mom? I heard
you
talk about this. Didn't you say that she got eaten by a tiger?
To this day, I don't know where exactly that came from, but that was my answer. I would tell, when kids would be like, what happened to your mom? I would tell them that she got eaten by a lion, and that would stop the conversation. You know, we're 5-6 years old, little kids, and it's like, my mom got eaten by a lion. So the kids would be like, you're a liar. Oh, my, what? You know? And then the story circulated around the school, and they got to the teachers, and then next, you know, I was having a parent-teacher conference about being a mischief kid that was making up stories and causing issues and things, that I was a liar.
So you're on the back pedal. Basically, you're already feeling society is, you know, treating you different. Naturally, you would start to build a little bit of a complex feel that you weren't what the norm is. You know, you are an outsider. How was that for you?
I hated school for the simple fact that I felt like an outsider in so many different ways. In the sense of going to school, I remember being every day at the Pledge of Allegiance. We did the Pledge of Allegiance every day at the beginning of class. That was like the school bell rang. We came into class and we did the Pledge of Allegiance. And the Pledge of Allegiance was like a bell inside of my head that told me I was alone. My mom would take me to school and drop me off at school, and I would run around the schoolyard with all the kids, right? Like, kid just wants to play. But as soon as the school bell rang and it was time to start school and the Pledge of Allegiance started, I noticed that I was alone. My mom wasn't there, and I was now alone, and I would cry. Every day, the beginning of school, I would cry. And I felt like an outcast. I was the only kid that would cry during the Pledge of Allegiance. I was the only kid that was being picked up by his grandma because his mom was dead.
Yeah.
And this was at a very, very young age that we were still... This was first grade, right? Not until second grade was my learning disabilities being highlighted, that I have a problem sitting down in my seat and paying attention, that I have a problem reading, that I have a problem with my spelling. I had issues. And so then there was another thing that was presented, that I was the outcast.
Yes.
I was the outcast because I had abandonment issues. I was 6 years old, 7 years old. I didn't know I had abandonment issues, but I had abandonment issues. And that's why I would cry every morning at school, because I felt that I was alone. When school was over and I was finally getting to go home with my mom, there was these comments of, where's your mom? And why is your mom gone? And then when school became school more of, you know, not so much just finger painting and letters, but actual school, sit down, write a sentence,
sure,
spell a word, I was lost again. So I became the outcast again. And I thought that I had found my answer. When I was being picked on and it was overwhelming, and I knew crying wasn't going to help, because I was crying before I got picked on, which caused getting picked on.
Yes.
So I lashed out. I fought. I punched I punch, I fight, I do whatever. And they would stop talking.
Yeah.
They would stop. They would stop with their comments. They would stop with their funniness. And it told me that I found my answer. Violence. If I'm bigger, badder, scarier than you, you're gonna shut up when it's my turn to talk.
Isn't that funny?
And
because I grew up very similar in reference. You know, I was broken home. I was a sexually abused child, and I was getting, you know, bullied and stood over, literally. And it was that turning point where I just lost the plot and become extremely violent, which put me on a path of destruction for the rest of my life. But it was a turning point between me feeling empowered and safe as a human,
yeah,
and me feeling totally outed and scared and alone.
And I mean, maybe that's the reason. I don't know if you felt that. See, I felt that so young that as I developed, I felt more of it when I became part of a tagging crew. And I was like, okay, now I'm bigger and badder. I got even more. And then I realized that even like gangs are the bigger and badder of that.
Yeah.
So I kept moving myself up in a sense of climbing the ladder, thinking that I was making myself bigger and badder.
Yep.
But I was climbing down deeper into a hole that would be so much harder for me to get out of.
What a way of putting it. I've had this chat, you know, on the Clink. We have guests that have been, you know, known for extreme notoriety, that have an amazing sort of story of redemption. And mine was the same. Start off on street level, you know, and then you become that guy that everybody's going, wow, this is good. And then you start moving and shaking, you know, you're involved in this and that. Start moving some drugs, being a little bit heavy. Next thing you know, you're the sergeant of arms of an international club. Off the back of that, though, there's 14 years of jail too, you know. Like, it's definitely not a life, is it?
It's not a life. And the thing is that the thing that's so ironic about it all is that as I climbed that ladder, thinking that I was becoming bigger and badder, and the idea in my head that I'm bigger, I'm badder, I'm stronger, was all in the sense of I will no longer feel pain. Yep. The bigger and the badder I am, the more that it's going to roll off my back. But all I did was create more pain that was going to sit on my back and never leave.
How old were you when you started, I suppose, stepping away from that school environment to streets and that new world of no one's going to fuck with me sort of thing?
So I went to Catholic school when I was growing up. My mom put me into Catholic school, and it was a very small school. And that was a big issue in the sense of why I was getting picked on, because it was so small of a school. Everyone knew everyone's issues. I got kicked out of that school in seventh grade for inhaling nitrous during DARE class. And
what was that? DARE class?
Yes. Anti-drug class.
Oh, okay. All right.
We had here in the States during the time we had this big push during schools called DARE. And it was the act of daring kids to stay off drugs.
Wow. And okay, so I mean, we don't have that sort of thing in our education system here. I'm sure that there's, you know, sex education, drug education, and whatever else. But that sounds like actually a really strong program that would, I'm assuming, help many.
Yeah, it did. In of giving information to children, it did. In my opinion, if you ask it, like, this is all spawning from the war on drugs, right? That we declared war on drugs here in America, and it's a war that we've lost every year.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, but in the sense of this school program being developed in the idea of war on drugs, it did give out a lot of information to kids and everything. I think that was really good. But in a child like myself, I had inhalants in my backpack, and then this police officer comes to school to say, hey, I'm going to teach you about inhalants today. I thought it was funny, so I just started inhaling drugs during class. Like, dude, this is hilarious, man. This cop's teaching me about the stuff I'm getting high on.
Wow.
And so this girl that was in my class saw me inhaling it and then told on me, and they found the drugs, and then I was kicked out of school. And from that school, I went to another private school. My mother was trying to keep me away from a lot of the street gangs and a lot of things that were in the public schools.
What was the area you grew up in, Chris, in America? Where exactly did you grow up?
Los Angeles.
So you were right in the center of, you know, crime central, basically, and you know, gang.
Yes.
where it all originated, right. Like, yes. Right there in the
where
thick
it
of
all,
it.
Yes, where it all started.
And not only that, like, too, and I don't want to sort of bring any racist sort of conversation, but you're a white man, and predominantly there would have been a lot of African Americans, I guess, back then, and a lot of you know, different multicultural sort of groups.
Yes. I am mixed. I am white, and I'm Irish and Mexican.
Yo, what a mix. There's the fighting warrior, and you're right there, mate. Yeah. Hey to us Irishmen. My grandparents from Ireland as well. Wow, what a mix.
So I ran with a Mexican gang. I was, cool. I got well, mixed cool. up.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I got introduced to the gang world, and which caused somewhat of a difficult thing, because I am so light-skinned, if not just to say white.
I just got to be careful about different words we use, because this is an international interview. I've got to be a little bit more conscious. For those out there that, you know, only assume, I guess, especially in Australia, what we hear, what was it like being in a Mexican gang? And you know, what was some of the stuff you got up to?
So when I got into the gang world, the way that I started tagging.
When you say tagging, as in writing, graffiti?
Yes, graffiti.
We all start there. I was a bomber as well. Yeah. Wow.
Right, taking our small steps as a criminal child.
Start doing panels of trains and sitting at train yards, watching them come running through the next morning, because you'd hit the yards that night. Oh, yeah.
Yes, yeah. And that was a rush, right? Being part of a crew, being part of everything. When I went to juvenile hall.
How old was this?
The first time I was arrested, I was 11 years old.
Wow. And what's the law over there? Like, how old can they actually put you into custody?
Oh, they put you into custody. I the youngest person I've seen in jail was 9 years old.
Are you kidding me?
A little 9 year old dude. I'll never forget him. I'll never forget his face. I have his face in my head like a picture. It'll never go away. He set his little brother on fire.
Wow.
He was 9 years old, and he was facing attempted murder, because he set his little brother on fire. He threw nail polish remover on him.
Wow.
And set him on fire. His mom's nail polish remover.
Isn't that, that's kind of crazy, bro. I'll tell you why. Because in Australia, we, you know, we have a certain age where it becomes, you know, I guess, don't get me wrong, there's kids out here driving stolen cars at 10 years of age, 11 years of age, you know, which is just unbelievably crazy. But do they get locked up and go to jail? No. That comes, you know, a little bit later. I think about 12, 13, you start becoming incarcerated for your actions.
Well, after I was arrested the first time, they did the kind of scared straight thing. They like walked me through the juvenile hall, and then they allowed me to my mother to come pick me up. And I was placed on probation. And they're like, if you violate probation, you're going to be going to juvenile hall. So I was messing up. It didn't scare me at all. I was, you know, the next day I was still doing the same thing. So my mom didn't want to see me go to jail. So she hired a transport service to snatch me up in the middle of the night and take me to Utah.
What?
To a boarding school.
Hang on a sec. Let me just put this in perspective. A transport unit that picks up a child and takes the child away.
So I remember that it was about 4 a.m. This guy wakes me up. He pokes me in bed and he's like, hey. And I'm like, what the hell? You know, he's like, you're coming with us. Stay calm. You're coming with us. And I was like, are you the cops? And he's like, we're not the cops, but you're coming with us. We're not going to answer any more questions. Please just follow our instructions and come with us. And I remember getting up out of bed and he helped me get dressed. When he pulled the blankets off of me and I was in my boxers. I was just, you know, I was in bed and there was a female in the room. So then she was like, oh, I'll go outside. He helped me get dressed because he didn't want me digging through my drawers. And then I started to get a little hostile. I was looking in my drawer for a weapon, starting to get a little hostile. And so he handcuffed me.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was like, you told me you weren't the cops. And he's like, we're not the cops. I'm only doing this because you're starting to get out of control.
So, sorry, Chris, can I just ask you a question? This is from a legal point of view. Your mother, whom the woman who you respectfully call mum.
Yes.
Did she, and you say, you know, you had transport, but did that mean she had to basically sign you over?
She paid for it.
Yeah, so.
Yeah.
More or less, she's just said, okay, take him away until, you know, his behavior changes or something, whatever.
She knew me better than I knew me.
Yeah.
She knew me better than I knew me. And that is the strong, and that is a true statement. And she knew that if she was to tell me that, hey, we're going to send you to Utah for a year or 6 months or anything so that you can work on becoming a better young man, I would have been like, okay, yeah, for sure. And I would have ran out the front door.
Gone.
I would have been like, catch me if you can.
Yeah.
So she knew to have me escorted there. She had to. And that was the thing, is that when once they like placed me and they had me in custody, put my sweater over my head, and I stepped out of my bedroom, I yelled for my mom. You know, I was, mom, people like, you know, and the guy was like, stop, no, shut up. Just stop. Your mom and dad aren't here.
Oh my goodness. Oh man, my heart just fell out my bum. Wow.
And I walked outside in my front, like walked out the front door of my house, and both my mom and dad's cars were gone. They weren't in the driveway. Both of their cars were gone. And they put me in the car and I was so scared. I remember that, like, being so scared that I couldn't think straight. Like, I was so young and I just didn't know what was going on. I kept thinking I was being kidnapped.
But why would you?
I legitimately thought I was being kidnapped.
How could you not? And look, let's talk about somebody who's grown up traumatized, you know, and feeling that everybody's against him. You're just constantly battling to then being up and handcuffed out of your own bed in your bedroom and just taken away with no one there to protect you. In your mind at that age, looking around you, and you're on your own, mate. You've got nothing and no one there to say, stop, that's Chris. Like, bring him back.
There was nothing.
Man, that just shatters me. Wow.
Dude, and so that was the last thing. That was the last thing that he had said for a little while. Your mom and dad aren't here. They're not here. And so when we got in the car and we drove away, I remember thinking, like, where are we going? Where are we going? Where are we going? And then us getting to LAX. And I had never been on an airplane in my life. Never flown anywhere in my entire life, and we pull up to LAX.
So how far is Utah from where you were? That's only 4,500 kilometers. So that's basically from one side of Australia to the other. You're being taken from your home.
Yeah. We're in California. You have to fly over Nevada and then land in Utah. When we pulled up to LAX, I remember having the thought that I was gonna go to China to like make Nikes for the rest of my life or something. You know, like. I thought I was being sold into slavery or so. I didn't know. I was like, and so we get there and we meet up with two other guys. and they have a kid. So I was being escorted in by a husband and wife, and then we met up with two other guys, and they had a kid too. And the kid was crying. Like, he was like, you know, he was crying, and I was just like, what is going on? And then the kid, I remember the kid like sniffling out, I need to go to the bathroom, right? He was like crying. He's like, I need to go to the bathroom. And I was like, me too, right? I'm thinking, maybe this kid got a, he got,
we're off.
Some movie. Yes. Yeah, we're going to do some movie, did it. We're going, you know?
Got myself a 5'8". We're on. Let's go.
The kid, one of the guys is like, I'll take him to the restroom. And we must have taken two or three steps. And this kid just took off running. Like, he just broke. We're in the middle of LAX. He just ran as fast as he could.
Wow.
And the other guy grabbed my hood, the hood of my sweater, before I could even react. Mm-hmm. And the other guy caught the kid, like, I don't know, like 10, 15 feet or something. Yeah. You know, the kid ran. The guy caught him, like,
yes,
grown man and a little kid.
Yeah.
But he brought him back by his head.
So very aggressively.
Very aggressively. I remember seeing the kid's feet off the ground. Maybe like I was a little traumatized, like, oh, he had him in a headlock. Maybe he had him more in like around his chest. But in my mind, I still remember him like he had like a, around his neck, like, you know, carrying the, you know. And I was like, oh, man, these guys aren't playing.
You so know, what would like, people be doing, Chris? Like, you're in LAX. It's not like there'd be nobody there. There would be hundreds of people passing, seeing what's going on.
There was no, like, this was, it was the weirdest thing. I don't remember anybody having any issue about anything having, like, anything going on.
No, like, one even saying, hey, look, yeah, doing, yeah, man? Like, hey, slow down, man. Well, what's going on?
Hey, you're a little, Ray, a little rough with that kid, you know? Like, no, I don't remember any of it, right? Like, there was no things like that. And then we finally get to our gate, and I see on the gate that we're going to Utah, Salt Lake City, Utah. And I'm like, why are we going to Utah?
Doesn't it snow there all year or something? Isn't it freezing cold there?
Yeah, Utah's freezing.
That's what I'm
coming from. SoCal, it's all sunny all day. And I'm like, I'm going to the middle of the snow. I don't
where's
know.
My,
I'm
where's
going.
My snow jacket?
The guy would absolutely refuse to answer questions. Like, he wouldn't say anything. And then finally, when we got on the plane and they closed the plane up and we started taxiing, right? Then he told me, he goes, look, man, you probably only want to know what the heck's going on. And I'm like, yeah, please. Like, you know? And he's like, look, your mom and dad hired my wife and I. We do a service that we pick up children and take them to different boarding schools for them to learn to be a better young man.
Yeah.
Your parents hired us. You're going to go to a school. Once you get to the school, you will contact your parents. You will talk to your parents and everything will be okay. But guys, the guy did apologize. He goes, look, I apologize for the way it went down, but my wife and I have been doing this for many years, and we have noticed, like, we have found out that going about this way is the simplest. Mm-hmm. You know, like, when the parents are there, the kids start, no, mom, I swear, yeah. I promise I'll be good. Don't let them take me. Don't let them take me. So they just exclude all that. We don't answer questions. Until we're on the plane. Once you're on the plane, there's no getting out of it. So then we'll answer your questions. And I remember telling him, like, man, dude, you could have told me. Like, and he's like, this is not what we do. And I was like, you could have just told me, man. I thought I was going to India or China or something. When I got there, I hated it. I mean, obviously, I was forced into a situation that I'm like, I don't want to be here. And I hated it tooth and nail. I couldn't wait to get the heck out of there. But as soon as I got back to California, I just kept doing the same stupid stuff and then ended up in juvenile hall, which then I was like begging to go back to Utah because I was like, I hated juvenile hall was jail. And like Utah, my mom was paying for me to be there. So it was a nice facility, you know?
What were the age? What was your age that you were coming back and then getting put into juvenile hall?
13. I was 12. I was just about to turn 13 coming back from Utah, and then I started going to the juvenile hall.
And what sort of crimes were they back then that you were starting with?
Vandalism, was my main crime because I was just tagging on everything that I could.
Yeah.
And then stealing. I was stealing alcohol, stealing. I had a put together like a little theft ring, like I guess kind of a thing. We were I would steal video games and DVDs from Blockbuster Video.
Yeah.
And then sell them back to them.
Really?
Yeah, as used. They would buy used games and used DVDs. So I would go to a certain city, the city next to me,
yeah,
and steal them all and then sell them in the city I lived in or vice versa.
You know, like you're talking from a young age of a way of thinking, brother, and look at who you are today. At that age, you're putting together if you go and get this from not even my own local area, but go out of my area to get what I want, to come back to make the money I need to do what I want to do.
Yeah.
Wow. So obviously from things grew bigger and better, huh, at that time?
Yes, definitely. More money. I needed more money. So I started stealing cars. That was my thing, was stealing cars, breaking into cars, breaking into houses. I used to set up like a little store. I know this sounds so funny, but I would go out all night. I was a meth head. I was addicted to meth.
At how old? 13, 14 years of age. You're already addicted to meth.
No, actually, the first thing was crack. So I was doing alcohol and weed and doing stuff like that. And then, I was introduced to crack cocaine when I was about 13.
Wow. And, which is extremely, for those that don't know, I mean, we have a lot of cocaine in Australia, but we don't predominantly have crack. Crack's the pure rock that comes from it being cooked back, correct?
Yes.
Which is extremely...
Cocaine, yeah, freebasing cocaine, freebasing, it's insanely addictive. It is... I was 13 years old, I was introduced to it, and... I was already doing things like stealing stuff from stores, robbing cars, doing stuff to make money. But then when crack was introduced to my life, it was that demand for the drug, like the way that my body needed it, the way that my body craved it, was something that hit me, blindsided me. You know, I was so young and I wanted the drug so bad, I was willing to do anything. I was stealing and robbing anybody. I went from stealing from stores to standing outside of stores trying to grab a purse.
Yeah.
You know, robbing my mom, robbing my family, my cousins, anybody I knew had money. And if I had a way of obtaining their money, then I was willing to do it.
This is in a period too, I guess, and quote me if I'm wrong, where crack was phenomenally an epidemic in America, wasn't it? It had come
yes,
in.
Yes, it was. It just basically... I was a little bit outside of the big crack epidemic. Yeah. I was born in the 80s.
Yeah.
And the 80s was the big crack epidemic of America. But crack is still very, very present today.
We have a big ice problem in Australia, which is, you know, meth. I guess you guys call it there. I don't know if you call it ice over there, but over here, you know, the glass shards of methamphetamines, and it is just, it's extremely sad. And I can only sort of relate it back to what maybe it was like when you were in, you know, your time with your crack addiction.
Well, the thing is that I was introduced to crack, and it was maybe 2 or 3 weeks. Maybe a little more, maybe 3 or 4 weeks, maybe like a month, a little over a month, that I was a crackhead, just straight fiending for crack and stealing and robbing and whatever I can do, selling anything I can do to get it. And then I was introduced to meth. And the funny thing is that I remember smoking crack. I had a crack pipe in my pocket and being introduced to meth and having this ego, like, meth, like speed, I don't fucking do that.
Yeah, dirty. It's like dirty shit.
Yeah, what the...
Yeah.
Dirty, like, you know? And then it like hit me in my head like, dude, you're smoking crack.
Little stone rocks in a little pipe.
Yeah,
like,
you're smoking crack.
It's the most filthiest thing.
It's not
going to
get any worse.
Yeah, yeah.
And you want to get high, you know? So I did the meth. because I was like, you know, why not? And it clicked in my brain. It's very unfortunate how well it clicked, because I believe that, like, I have an addictive personality. My parents, I was born through addiction. And then at the same thing is that at the, in the second grade, I believe I was about 8 years old. I was put on Ritalin.
Yes. ADD, ADHD.
Medication.
Yep.
Yes. Which is amphetamine. It's ephedrine.
Yep.
It's time released ephedrine. So, I think that when I was introduced to meth, my body had just accepted it, because it was already taking it in different ways. But, and then the idea of me being a rebel, right? I'm not doing the right. I'm doing a drug, an illegal drug, because I'm a badass. And then my body just clicked with it that meth took over my life.
Did you find, it Chris, like, because of the fact that dexamphetamines or Ritalin, same thing, you know, I know that, you know, it's given to people whom can't sit still, have, you know, very bad attention deficit disorders, but it brings you back to a level of being able to feel good. You're on a happy high. Your serotonins are all good. Everything feels good. So, you know, is that what meth did for you, but on steroids? Gave you this just unbelievably, I feel good feeling.
I feel good. And the thing is that something that I picked up on when I was doing meth and everything is that when people do meth, they're tweaking, right? They're constantly jittering. They're doing this, they're doing that. People pick their face, people draw, people do all these little weird things, right? But because I have such severe ADHD and my body was already used to taking this ephedrine, that so I would do meth and I would sit there like if I had just smoked weed.
That's right. It made you normal.
And it freaked people out.
Yeah.
People around me, like I would be doing meth with a room of people and everybody's, oh, they can't sit still there, you know, and I'm sitting there calm, cool as a cucumber. They're like, what the fuck is wrong with him?
Did you find that people sort of started to, like, get paranoid that you were able to be this way as opposed to everyone else being like high as fuck?
Exactly. And that's what I fed on, because at such a young age that I was being picked on for being the different one, being picked up by his grandma, being the one that's on pills, being the one that cries in the morning, being picked on for all these different things, that I realized that if I lash out, if I instill fear in their heart, then I have nothing to fear of them. If they fear me first, then I don't have to fear them.
Absolutely.
So, like, being in a drug house, being in a fucking drug den where it's nothing but shady business, and if I can sit in that room and the rest of the room is paranoid about me,
you're winning.
I'm winning.
Oh, yeah. You're fucking with people's heads straight up without even having to put on the aggression. People are just going, this guy's psyched. He's gone. He's fucking cooked.
Yes. And so I fed on that. And all these little different things is what made the bad me shine so bright, which I thought was shining so bright, becoming what I thought that was going to be a good image for me. Because at a young age, I realized that my violence and my willingness to act on violence is what's going to push me to run the show. And now here I am years later and it's still happening. And we're in the shadiest position of it all, a crack house or a drug house. And I can still instill that fear, just like I did in third grade in this school setting. And I made it out of that school setting, even though I was scared and I was and I broken. I made it out of that with this carrying of violence. So now when I found myself in being able to carry that forward in a different setting, it just reinstilled in my head, this is what you need to do. Being violent.
Did you start to become, I guess, I mean, look, for me, I had a lot of mates. It was a heroin epidemic, basically, growing up for me. I'm 44 and, a lot of mates died overdoses to heroin. And I... for some reason, I was that guy that was chasing the uppers. You know, I was using what we call speed or amphetamines back when I was quite young as well, 13, 14. And I liked that up. And then I got that little bit because of my bipolar and, you know, ADHD as well. I found a little bit normality. I could just be always on the ball. No one knew what I was thinking. But I also seen the dollar value in it back then. I thought, you know what? If everyone's going to be going and buying gear from someone, why the fuck can't they be buying it from me? I wasn't using the heroin, you know what I mean? So that was my introductory. Was it like that for you? Did you start to realize that, man, there are these people around me. They need what I can get. Did you start moving in a way like that?
Well, the thing is that it wasn't really a sense of what they want. Like, I sold drugs just for the money. Like, okay, how can I make some cash? I'm doing drugs and I know a lot of drug addicts. So it only makes sense that if I carry drugs in my pocket, I can make
exactly
some money.
Exactly my point. Yeah.
And but the thing is that where I really focused my attention was smaller things. Like I had these friends that wanted to rob these businesses, right? They want to rob this and want to rob this. Let's do a big score. Let's rob a bank. Let's rob a blah, blah, blah. And I started realizing at a young age the difference in a crime with the results of the crime.
Yep.
Right? If we run up on this guy at a stop sign while he's driving his car and put a gun in his face, pull him out of the car and we steal his car, right? That's called a carjacking.
Correct.
That carries life. They'll give you life. They'll give you the death penalty in some cases for that crime.
Really?
Yes. Wow. But if I follow this man home, let him go in the house and go to sleep, and I break into his car and steal it while he's asleep, then I end up with the same result of the same car. But if I'm caught, I'll do a year.
Like 2 years. It's just car theft. That's it. Just stealing.
It's just car theft.
Wow.
So then I started to understand that, like, okay, if I steal enough things, I can make that big money. I would go out there and I would steal these different cars and I'd break into these houses and I'd break into these things. And so, like, I started realizing that at the end of the day, I'm tweaked out. I'm going hotel to hotel. And then I'm realizing, like, dude, I got 3 iPads, 2 laptops, 7 cell phones. I got all this crap and I got to lug it around everywhere.
Yeah. Yep.
Right. So I would set up like a store in a hotel room. Wow. Everything was $100.
It didn't
Nothing
matter.
Was over $100.
What a bargain.
Nothing was over $100. So if it was like a laptop,
yeah,
that was like, you know, a very expensive $1,000
laptop,
that's $100.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Right? But if it was like an iPod, so I would end up with a bunch of those because people had those in the thing, right? So I would rubber band 2-3 of them together and be like, okay, $100. Because they're like $100 regular and you're not going to pay $100 normal, but I want $100. That's all I want is $100. So then I would make a bundle of them. So 5 iPods for $100. But it was just easier for me to move.
Well, every 10 sales, you know, you say you've got a room full of stuff. It's $1,000 for 10 items.
Exactly. That's exactly how I looked at it, was items.
Mm.
Every item was a $100 bill.
Yes.
If I can get enough items, then I get enough $100 bills.
Exactly.
And then that's the same thing I did with the cars. So when I was stealing cars, like, I can go out, break my head, trying to get this brand new Mercedes that I can sell someone for like $5,000, $10,000, something, I don't know. Or I can steal this Honda Civic and get like $500 and I'll steal like 6 of them a night.
Yeah, because they're so easy. And just a screwdriver and bang, you're gone.
Dent pull.
Slide hammer.
Just rip, rip the ignition
ting,
out.
Ting, ting.
Yep, good to go.
I remember.
And it's the most popular car everywhere, so you can find 5 of them on one street.
How funny is that? Slide hammers. Like, we literally would walk around the streets doing the same thing when we were younger, you know? Oh, you can't get that. We can get that. Boom, boom. Got the weight on the end of it. Smack, smack. Out comes. Yep. Screw in. Boom, you're gone.
You're gone.
That was so good.
It was so good.
I think, do you think people even know what a slidey is today? Do you think people would even know? They wouldn't know. If you said, dude, have you got a slidey? They'd be like, fucking what?
A slider is what you call it, huh?
Slidey, yeah. Slide hammer. Because if you remember, you had the rod and the little screw tip on the front. Yeah. And then you had your weight.
It had it looked like a dumbbell.
Yeah, that's right. Boom, boom. And so that was the hammer. A slide hammer.
A dent puller.
Yeah, well, the professional name, and that was the thing, to get them, you sort of had to be a tradie. You had to have a panel beating service, you know, where you took your car to get fixed. So, you know, we would try and track down someone we knew and it was shady and sort of throw them a couple of dollars, and then it'd be like, yeah, sweet, we've got a slide hammer. £5, £2, £3 slidey.
Yes.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's nuts. So You obviously, and once again, I'm talking to you and listening, I can see how intelligent you are. Your mindset is not the average person.
Thank you, I appreciate that.
And look, I mean that seriously. You know, one thing that I've learned in my life is sort of understanding people, especially with, you know, growing up in gangs in the streets. And tell us more about that transition. You know, you're on the streets.
So
you've obviously climbing the ladder, and then bang, you're in jail. And I believe you're in federal jail too, yeah?
No, state prison. State. Not federal prison, but state prison. And
what's the difference, Chris, for us in Australia?
The big difference, I guess, in there's state crime and federal crime, right? The difference as a criminal, right? I would always understand this. This is the way I looked at it when I was doing time. When I got state time, they can send me anywhere in the state of California.
Okay.
Because, right? So I would sometimes, like the last time I was in prison, I was something like 10 hours away from my home.
Yep.
Like a 10-hour drive from my home. Now, in federal prison, they can send you to New York. they can send me to the other part of the country.
Really?
But because it's all federal. Now, under the law, federal laws are a lot stricter. If you're facing a federal crime, you're going to do 80% of your time, no less than 80% of your time.
My last charge was federal, but in Australia, and I was looking at 10 years, was lucky enough to get away with 6 for commercial importation. But I served my sentence in just a state prison. So I committed the crime in the state of New South Wales. Yes, I was sent to jail 14 hours from home, don't get me wrong, but it was all within that New South Wales state, even though I was a federal inmate. It's different here, and this is, I guess, the thing that a lot of people hear, and we have a lot of people that would be curious about what we're talking about, that listen, is that whole understanding of, yeah, federal, you can be put anywhere. I mean, that's wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. State, you'd be on the opposite side of the country.
Yeah.
Because once you're federal property, then you're federal property.
So there's zero consideration for rehabilitation and making sure that, you know, you're close to your families, or, you know, they're making efforts so you get visits or anything like that.
If anything about rehabilitation, I would say that here in the States, the federal prison, I believe that I have never been to federal prison. So through experience, I couldn't really speak very much. But from what I know of people that have been to federal prison, people that I've talked to or anything, that federal prison seems to have a better funding.
Yeah.
Because it's federal, it's the entire country. It has like a lot more funding to it, so the chances of rehabilitation are greater. I'm guessing.
Yeah.
But through my experience of state prison, the idea of rehabilitation is bullshit.
Is it a lot short? What would be the maximum sort of serving time that you would do in a state prison? Like, is it under a certain 5 years or 10 years, or you can doing
state
life?
Prison is,
can you still be doing life in state?
Okay. Lots of people doing certain sentenced to life, sentenced to death.
Really? Under state?
Oh yeah. And that's the thing about America is because we have the 50 states and we have different state laws, California, Texas, there's a good handful, a good number of states that carry the death penalty, but then there's also states that don't carry the death penalty.
And you have the three strike rule, don't you?
In California, yes, we do.
So each state is different for that rule to apply.
Yes. And that three strike rule has been remodeled over the years because when it first came out, it was three strikes and you're done.
Life.
Yes, life. God, you're done. And it still means that three strikes, you're done. You got life still. But there was a very large group of people that was getting life for their third strike. The two strike deal was you're pretty much done, right? They looked at it as, if you got two violent crimes, then you're done. And they're only waiting to give you life. So there was a large number of cases that were like somebody would rob a bank, rob a liquor store, and then get caught with some drugs. So the thing is that they started to change that, and where the third strike to result in life has to be violent. There's a documentary on Netflix. It's called 13th. And for any of your listeners or anything that are interested in the idea of rehabilitation and why America has such a high prison population and things like that, it's a very good documentary to insight that the system in our jail system is designed not so much for rehabilitation, but for slavery.
Wow.
Because once you are part of the system, they don't want to let you go.
Does life mean life, Chris? Like here, it used to mean 10 years. You got a 10-year, what we call a brick. And, it was termed you're doing life. In years since then, it's now life is life. You're looking at 25, 30 years. Do you get that? Is there a chance to be released once you've given your three strikes? And, you're gone? That's it. Life's life. See you later.
Yes. If you're given life, there's life without the possibility of parole, and there's 25 to life, or there's 10 to life. So there's a sentence that you can say get 10 to life, where you have to serve 10 years.
10 years, yeah.
And then after the 10 years, you're eligible to be released.
But there's no guarantee.
Every year you have to go to the parole board.
Yes.
And because you have that L on the back of your sentence, they can literally deny you until the day you die.
Was this around when you were in your prime of crime and the life you were living? Or did you sort of... It was.
Yeah,
so
life.
How did you get around not being that person to receive a life sentence, because your crimes would have been quite violent?
I would try to figure out a way to execute the same exact crime without the conditions of life.
Got you. Okay.
Right? Like where, if somebody told me that there was a person that had $100,000 in their house, I would break into their house when they weren't home and get a burglary charge instead of running in their house when they're home.
Home invasion.
Tying them up and home invasion, and now I'm facing life.
Yeah.
I'm still going after that same exact goal of what they have in the house.
What a mindset.
I'm just not putting myself in front of the firing squad.
You're a tacticianist. You'd be a great coach. Well, you are a coach anyway, and we'll get into that shortly, aren't you? So that sets it up for another part of your life, obviously, ahead. Mate, the gang life in jail, we obviously see and hear things here. And look, I'll be honest, over my years, it's very strong in Australia. I don't believe our system's anywhere near as hardcore as what you guys live with over there. How did you find it going in and out of jail? And, was it more in the state system that it was predominantly heavily gang-related as opposed to non?
If you go to state prison, in California and you do not associate with somebody, you're going to have a very hard time.
Yeah. Yeah, very vulnerable.
You are going to associate with somebody because it's all broken down by race.
Yes.
Right? So the whites are housed together, the blacks are housed together, the Mexicans are housed together. So
they don't intermix.
Gangs, they are intermixed in the sense of we're on the same yard, but they won't put us in the same cell.
Really? So they'll let you go out in the same yard where, I mean, obviously you all have your own little space and areas, but where everyone's more vulnerable.
But that's what they want.
Fuck, that's just race war shit.
The last thing they want, this is something that I realized like growing, like getting older and realized it's so much profound now outside, is that the last thing that any prison guard wants is for the inmates to become one.
And all get on. Yeah, right.
Because you figure a prison's going to have what? 10,000, 15,000 inmates? And they're going to have at one given time, what? 500 people working?
Maximum. Yep. And they'll be just overridden. And everybody's one unit. Get it. I totally get it.
Yeah. If every prison, like if every prisoner became one gang, there was no way that they could. So they want us segregated. They want our gangs to be fighting once another. They want racial tension because that keeps us divided. And that keeps us in the sense of that they can control us.
Absolutely.
Because if we were all one, then it would be.
Wow. They wouldn't know where it's coming from.
Yeah. There's no way that they could have enough manpower to control us.
Did you see a lot in your time inside?
Yeah. Riots were scary, dude. Honestly.
You come to the realization through doing what we call here Segro, which I think you guys call the hole. You're locked down after, was it a fight, a gang fight or something like that? Do you want to talk to us about that?
I got into a riot with a rival gang, a rival prison gang, and ended up in the hole.
So you were Mexican affiliate with this gang that you're with? Yep.
Yes. And it wasn't a very large one, but I think it broke down to about 15 on 12, something in that bracket. You know, it wasn't really big, but we got after it. You know, it was a pretty good rumble for a little while. And when I went to the hole on that one,
was it serious to the point where people stabbed and stuff like that? Like, I mean, over here, it's that's what's gonna happen.
Somebody got hit with something that they think that it was just a coffee mug.
Yeah.
But there was no blades or anything.
Yep.
It was very spontaneous. It wasn't planned in any way.
Yeah.
The more violent ones is like when we know that we're gonna riot the next day.
Yes.
Or something like that. Like we're going to attack somebody.
Yeah.
Or we know that you know then we're a little more prepared. But when it's spontaneous, it just kind of just cracks off and you start throwing fists, you know? And when that happened, I went to the hole and I was writing a letter to my mom. At this time that during this prison term, this was my third adult prison term.
Were you still using drugs too? Were you using meth while in jail?
No.
So you would be clean in the system?
Yeah.
Because I mean, like here, there's more drugs in jail. You know what I mean? Like,
oh yeah,
the addiction. I remember sitting there looking at you know 5-6 guys sharing a broken down little fit. You know, on what we call Suboxone or something like that, or methadone. You know, and they're all sitting there having a shot that someone's just spat out of their mouth. Like it's the same there, same sort of stuff.
Same thing. And but the thing is that drugs are the main issue in prison. Like when you see someone stabbed or when you see something go down, a lot of the time it's because of drugs.
Yeah.
It's in the sense of drugs that like this gang is trying to take over that gang's drug territory, or this guy owes a bunch of money for drugs and can't pay, so they have to stab him, or somehow, like, you know, like if you hear about an issue happening one day, if you follow the information all the way back, it's probably originates from drugs.
Yeah. Yep.
Somehow, right?
So you chose to stay away from that sort of environment. The fact
when
that,
I was know. In prison, I was in my element of thinking that I was at work. Yeah. I wanted to become somebody. I understood at the age of 14, I gave up. I told my mom, I was like, look, mom, I'm going to die in here. I'm going to die a very bad person, you know? And the sooner that you accept this, the sooner I'll be able to accept this, and the sooner that we will stop hurting. Because I was like 14, 15 years old, but I had already gone in and out so many times that every time I'd go in, my mom would be like, why? Like, you can change. I know you can change. And why do you do this? And why? And like, I would destroy her every time I'd go to jail. And so when I was like 14, 15, I told my mom, like, mom, I'm going to die in here. Like, this is me.
So you'd accepted this, like, was your path. That was it.
I accepted it. And I was trying to get my mom to accept it, because every time I'd go in there, I would hurt. I would destroy her. And then it would destroy me knowing that I destroyed her.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't give a honestly, I didn't give a shit. Like, I was drugged out and I was ruthless. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was robbing anybody. I didn't care. But to watch my mom hurt still hurt me. And so I was trying to tell her, like, we need to accept that this is what it's going to be. And it's going to hurt us less when I come in here.
For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. For the record, lab on me going all the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. For the record.
Want to thank a new sponsor who's just come on board, Dr. Pickles Tattoo Aftercare and Lifestyle Products. They're made in Brisbane and are known right around the world. They have this amazing balm. It's called the Original Tattoo Balm. You seal and protect your tattoo with the OG. I've just been using it on my leg after I had it done, and I tell you now, my skin feels amazing and there's a great shine to it. They also have an antiseptic spray you can spray on and wipe over your tattoo to keep it nice and clean so you don't get any infections. They've got a 3-in-1 wash. It's all natural, smells great, packed full of peppermint, citrus, and wait for it, hemp oils. How good is that? Plus, they have a SPF 50 sunscreen, which acts as a moisturizer as well as protecting your tattoos from fading and stop them from getting sun damage. Right now, though, for the Clink listeners, they're offering 15% off with the code CLINK. Just head to drpickles.com. That's drpickles.com.